Welcome to Vistage Live, the place you can come to for insights, knowledge, and perspectives from a range of experts who can help your small and mid-sized business make a great big impact. Today's guest is Mark Bregman, one of our newest Vistage chairs with a stellar career in global business leadership and technology strategy. Mark's entrepreneurial spirit has led him to a diverse career in both Fortune 500 companies and startups. As CTO at Veritas, Mark led its integration with Symantec and key acquisitions. He later grew a Symantec Huawei venture from $32 million to $700 million and drove NetApp's cloud storage expansion on Azure and AWS. More recently, he launched a New Zealand venture fund, investing in 20 companies and supporting US market entry. So with deep expertise in scaling businesses and global strategy, we're thrilled to have Mark as a chair in New Zealand and to have him today on Vistage Live. Welcome, Mark.
Well, thank you very much.
Good to see you. So, Mark, we'll get to New Zealand and we'll get to your chairing and your group very soon. Why don't we start off with the kind of bigger world where you spent the bulk of your career? I'd like to explore what you learned then about entrepreneurship that has led you to where you are today in New Zealand.
Well, sure. I think there are several things I learned. I started my career in a very large company. After my PhD in physics, I went to work at IBM,
right.
Which in around 1992, I'd been there for several years, had over 400,000 employees. And IBM was facing a crisis at that time. So I learned an amazing amount going through that crisis. From that peak of 400,000 employees, and I was an executive by then, we reduced the workforce by 140,000 people in a year.
Wow.
In order to stay alive.
Mm.
And so, as they say, a near-death experience concentrates the mind.
Yeah.
And I don't recommend that, but it's really what we live with. And so learning how to work through that and do it in a way that was both economically and business effective, but also kind in a way, not what's happening right now in the US, but actually a way that was satisfying or helpful to the other employees was very useful.
Yeah.
Part of what I learned there was the importance of collaboration, partnership outside the company.
Okay, tell me more about that. Yeah.
Well, I'll give you an example. I mean, I was, for part of that, I was still inside the IBM research division, and we'd made some hard decisions to discontinue investment in certain areas.
Mm.
And we had to go, in my role, I don't know why I drew the short straw, was to go talk to these people who were among the top five in the world at their expert field.
Mm.
And tell them, we're not going to do that anymore. And one of them was almost in tears and said, but if we don't do that, we won't be a leader in that anymore.
Mm.
And I thought to myself in my head, so what? Because I knew it didn't have the business impact, but I didn't say that. I said, well, you're right. But it turns out we think that we can partner with people outside to get access to that. In fact, what we're suggesting is if you want to take this early retirement package, we're also willing to help you get a position in the university and donate all of the equipment you already have in your lab and potentially fund some of the research you do in the first few years, because there's a tail end to what we're doing. So we were found a very smooth way to do that. And that was true across the board. That was one example. But it taught me an important lesson about the importance of being human.
Yes.
In business decisions.
Yes.
And at the same time, we still had very hard-nosed business decisions we had to make. So being human or being kind isn't being soft. And as we, again, can see in the current environment, not only in the U.S., where it's very apparent every day, but in other parts of the world, people don't always do that. And it has repercussions.
Do you know, it's really interesting that you say that, Mark, because I think of Vistage members. And it's that balance of empathy and accountability that comes
exactly.
up. And I know that's that's part of the loneliness of leadership, isn't it? When there's decisions that have to be made that don't feel kind, and how a leader can balance that. That's really interesting.
I couldn't agree more. And I think the thing that is quite unique about Vistage and the Vistage group is you're not there to get advice. It's not an advisory group.
No.
It's a supportive group. Supportive in the sense of looking at your problem that you may bring to the table from a different perspective, because we all have different perspectives, using that to help the individual clarify where they're headed and what they're doing, and providing that support that, as you said, keeps you from being lonely and sleepless at night.
Mm.
You know, there are other people who are aware of it, who perhaps have been through something similar, have shared their experiences, and that helps you as a leader make your own decision. You're not letting someone else tell you how to do it, because they're not in your shoes, but you're taking their input as a way to support your own decision. And that's crucially important.
Well, it's that feeling that someone's got your people have your back, this kind of cheer squad behind you when you're still doing what you need to do. Let's go back then. So post IBM, what were your main learnings then in a very significant career that you had in the US and overseas? But what were the biggest learnings that have helped you think, form who you are now as a leader and a mentor and a chair?
I guess one of them, because I split my time and my career between very large, mature organizations like IBM, Symantec was 10,000 people, others, and very small organizations that are early stage startups. And at a high level, the biggest distinction is when you're doing an early stage small startup, you're actually doing what I would call science. You don't know what's out there. You create a hypothesis, and you come into the office in the morning. You say, okay, today I'm going to do this experiment to test my hypothesis. And the interesting thing about science is you learn way more when you invalidate your hypothesis.
Yeah.
It forces you to think of other alternatives. Now, if you're in a big company like an IBM or a large bank or something like that, and you come in the morning, you have a hypothesis, let's try this, and it fails, you've probably affected a big part of your revenue or your employee base or your customers or all of them. And that is not acceptable. That's engineering as opposed to science, in which you say, well, we know all of this history of what we've done. We are going beyond that, but we're going to extrapolate and manage the risk. It's not the same thing as science. And I think that we see a lot of people who grow in business from startups who have a hard time making that transition. That's why often early stage founders end up moving aside and bringing in a CEO who comes from that other side.
Mm.
But it's also a challenge because people who've only spent their time in the big organizations, often when faced with challenges that require transformation, are so hesitant. They're trying to engineer a solution, and they haven't understood that they can do some small scale experiments and move much faster. Don't do an experiment with your whole customer base. Maybe do something smaller scale, but that allows you to learn and learn faster. And so there is something to be said for bringing even that science approach into the large organization.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to go, actually. So with a PhD in physics, obviously science is one of your drivers, or it's inherent in you. How did you bring that into some really big organizations?
Well, I've been mostly in the tech industry, so there's some foundation usually of science anyway.
Mm.
But there are a few things I've learned. A good example of that is actually coming from my background as getting a PhD. I was sort of an academic, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things I've found is that I'll apply this to board members, but it could be investors in small companies. When you have somebody who is not your boss directly, but they're your advisor, it's very interesting tension between, or maybe even a coach, it's a very interesting tension between asking them and then doing what they say and how they communicate that. So the example I practice with every one of the founding CEOs that are in companies I've invested in, and I'm on the board of most of them, is I preface almost every, they come to me with a question, and I preface almost every answer with, to the point where they get angry at me. They say, Well, this might be an incredibly stupid idea, but have you thought of doing this or that or the other thing? And the reason I do that is I actually don't want them to go and do that thing.
Yeah.
I want them to think about doing that thing. And my favorite founder is a very earnest and very straightforward scientist who will sit and listen and look at me and internalize everything. And then he'll go away and he'll come back the next day and he'll say, "You know, that was an interesting idea, but it's actually not a good idea. But it made me think about this other thing, and I think we should do this." I go, "Oh my God, that is the
Perfect.
right answer."
That's
And
perspective, isn't it? Yeah.
in many ways, that is a little bit of the secret sauce of the Vistage
Yeah.
issues processing method, which is asking questions for, as a, and you know, posing questions, not answers, and ask, and then the individual can guide theirs because they know more about it than anyone else in the room. Same thing when you're a graduate student. If you think your advisor knows more than you, you're sorely uninformed because the advisor hasn't looked at that problem for 25 years. And by the way, it's a new problem. By definition, that's what you do for a PhD. So when you go in there, you know more about it than anyone else. Doesn't mean you don't need help. And that's where an advisor in a PhD program comes in. A good professor does exactly that. The other thing that I find interesting, and it's a little bit more on the people side, is a good, I'll stick with the idea of a PhD advisor, but you'll see the analogy. A good advisor measures their worth or their success in the success of their students.
Yes.
And even to the point where you'll, at someone's retirement, you'll hear Professor Smith, who's retiring after God knows how many years, and they'll talk about the success in terms of all the well-known leaders in the field that were students under him
Yeah.
or her.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important thing when you're a leader like a CEO. If you can have that view that the success, obviously there are metrics like the success of the business, but you also with your team, it's the success of the team. And again, yes, you're the conductor of that orchestra. Probably the first violinist is better at violin than you are, but couldn't perform in the orchestra without your guidance. And that is comes from my experience in academia, because that's the way it works, as I said, but it's crucially important in leadership roles in business as well.
So you would have had some very big teams at Veritas and Symantec in the day. You've had some really big teams. How did you lead through your people, lead through your own leadership team rather than I know it's a challenge for so many leaders to think, well, I can do it better myself, I'll get it done, or it's in my head, I know where we're going, I just can't communicate it. How did you ensure you were effective at leading through others?
Something I learned actually, and I don't even know how I learned it or where I learned it. I'm sure there was some mentor that I learned it from early in my career as I became a first, I started as an individual contributor. I was a scientist in the lab. And then I got promoted to a first line manager. And it was like magic. All of a sudden, I had four pairs of hands in addition to mine, all doing kind of the same thing. And it was almost like being a puppeteer. But as you move up in management and you get more further away from the coal face, so to speak, the way you operate has to change. And so my view is that at that level, I could sit down with my team and tell them what they needed to do that day, because if they didn't do it, I could do it better because I was more experienced. Then you get promoted, and now you've got four, three or four or five managers who each have four or five people. Maybe you're, because of the breadth, some of those people are doing things that you don't have the expertise in. And you can start to manage more through setting a little bit higher level context or plan, and then trusting your team, making sure they're the right people to operationalize it. When you get up to the level of a CE or in a general manager, I literally had thousands of people in my team. I didn't know all of them. To this day, people walk up to me and say, "Oh, I'm so and so, and I used to work for you, and blah blah blah." And I have to admit, you know, I was up at the front giving the talk in the 1,000-person auditorium, and you were one of the I but here's what you have to do. It becomes an ability of setting the culture and the high-level objective or context and communicating relentlessly, not only through your team, in you know, from you to your directs, from them to their directs, and all the way down, but also broadly. So even the people as I just mentioned, who are sitting in the auditorium when I'm giving a talk, feel like they know me because they heard it from me, not from five levels below me. And I think it's you're no longer able to operationalize it by yourself at that scale. You're no longer able to even understand all the workings of it, but you have to be able to describe it in a way that everybody can understand. There's a very interesting process that I learned when I lived in Japan, worked in Japan for IBM, and it's very common in Japan. It's known as Hoshin Kanri, and it means, loosely translated, direction deployment. And every year we used it, and the CEO or the head of IBM Japan, 35,000 person organization, would put together his objectives for the year. And they would be high level objectives: grow revenue by this much, improve customer satisfaction by this much, launch this, whatever it is, very, very high level business objectives. And sometimes there are personal objectives, improve employee wellness, whatever it was. And he'd write it down very concisely, and he would hand that to his immediate reports. And they would look at it and they would say, well, given my role, my job, here's what I can do to support these three goals. I have nothing to do with that one, so I'm not going to say anything, but I'll write mine down. And then I'll take my goals, which are those supportive goals, and I'll give them to my direct reports. And they repeat the process all the way to the bottom of the company. I was managing a semiconductor manufacturing plant. The person at the bottom of the company was the person who literally was the janitor in the clean room. They were a high school graduate. They came in every day. They didn't make a lot of decisions about their job. But because this process, at some point, they got a thing from their immediate manager that said, here's our goal. Our goal is to reduce the defect level in the chips by this amount by having a cleaner floor. And then this person would look at it and go, yes, I'll clean the floor better. And then it goes back up the chain, and the staff start looking for gaps. Like, wait a minute, nobody's addressing this high-level goal. Bob, that why aren't you? Oh, I thought Sally was going to do it. Well, somebody's got to do it. Who's going to pick it up? And so that's a very interesting. I don't recommend it necessarily because it doesn't work in the culture, in different cultures. But if you think of that model, that's the role you're playing as a senior leader. You're sitting there setting the high-level goals. You have to ensure they get connected all the way down. That's the communication process.
It's so interesting, and that absolutely relates, I think, to the role of a CEO, owner, founder of a mid-sized business. It's the
Absolutely.
same thing.
Yeah,
What
you don't have to have 35,000 employees.
No,
This works in,
well, you don't.
I recommend this to the startups when they get to about 20 employees, which means they're not having lunch together every day.
Which fits in with the kind of people that you're talking to in New Zealand, obviously. What are you seeing as the biggest issue for CEOs, business owners in New Zealand of mid-sized businesses?
I think one of the really big challenges is, and this is, as an outsider, my observation of the culture, maybe incomplete, but when I bring this up, I get lots of nods from Kiwis around the table. I challenge them a little bit and I say, it seems to me the Kiwis are actually not very good at networking when they're in New Zealand, and everyone nods their head. But when they're outside New Zealand, they're brilliant. They're some of the best networkers on the planet. What's going on? And I think there's a culture of self-reliance. Got to do it myself. There is a culture in which people form their groups, their mates in school. And unlike the US, where we do that at each level of our career and build a network, that doesn't seem to happen as much here. So when you do get to be a leader of your own business or CE of a company, a big company, you don't have that existing network of maybe former colleagues who've moved into other companies. You can pick up the phone and I could say, well, Stephanie, I haven't talked in a while, but it was great when we used to work together at XYZ company, and I really have a lot of respect for your experience in this area, and I wonder if you could just, I could bounce some things off of you. They don't have that here in the same way we do in the US.
I'm thinking
And so
I'm in Australia.
it might be, I just don't have the experience as much in Australia, but it's very, very clear to me that that's true here. And so I think something like Vistage or other things like that play an even more important role. Maybe it's a little bit artificial. I mean, these aren't the people that you met because you ran into them. It gets formed by on purpose. But at the same time, it provides you that safe, confidential, supportive environment. And the members of the groups that I've seen do build those kind of trusting connections and bonds pretty quickly in this in the environment of the Vistage meetings. And that's a hugely valuable asset for a leader.
It is. Tell me about your group. What does your group look like, and what's the vision for your group, Mark?
Well, I'm trying to put together a group that is clearly a group of ambitious founders, or not just founders, ambitious executives. Some of them are founders, some of them are executives who've been hired in, who have a global view, and in many cases, because they're ambitious, they look to growth or expansion or connection outside of New Zealand itself. I look for diversity, and by that I don't just mean the normal types of diversity of gender diversity or age diversity or what have you. I also mean this diversities of industries, because again, all the things we've talked about until now about the role of a CEO have nothing to do with whether you're in the food business, the property business, or you're a nuclear scientist building reactors. It doesn't matter. The problems we face as senior leaders are cross-cutting. And so having that diversity brings other perspectives. If everybody's doing what you're doing, first of all, you're going to be strained. Oh, they're my competitor, whatever. But even more importantly, they're not going to bring a different perspective. And so I'm making a big effort to get that kind of diversity. And I'm talking to people that are in the mid-sized healthcare. I'm talking to people who are running very large retirement fund businesses. I'm talking to people who are in manufacturing. One of the people who's in our group is actually probably by the numerical measurements, maybe a little bit too small, a little bit too early, very ambitious, and has experience as a senior executive in very large companies by New Zealand standards. And so he specifically wants to be with people who come from that world, not the small business group. So he feels that would constrain him. I think that's wonderful. And I suspect he's met a couple of the other members, and until he got to the point of actually describing his business, everything else he was talking about, they thought he was in an equally large and mature business he sees that as pulling him up. He'll also bring to the table, because he's been in big businesses, some of what I said earlier about challenging the ideas of, well, we can't do that. As you know, yes, we've got this challenge, and we can't move that fast because we're big. Yeah. Really? Have you thought about this?
Yeah.
So I think that's a good thing. Part of the value in these groups is they're very supportive, but it's also safe to challenge people.
Yeah.
You have a phrase I think I've heard you use, a word that sort of made up word.
Carefrontation.
Carefrontation. I think that's it's an awkward word, but it's actually a very important idea. It's, you know, being a little bit provocative and confrontational, but also having a long-term care for the group, for the team, the members of the group, and for the individual.
Absolutely.
So that's part of the soft side, very powerful part of the soft side of leadership. Being able to sit down with an employee in your team and be that way. You've got to challenge them. We've got a business challenge. We've got to do this. But you can do it in a way that's caring and supportive.
You've made me think of another word, another Vistage word I heard this week for the first time. And it's talking about a solution that's masking as a question. So a quolution.
But I certainly know a lot of those. I'm very good at doing that. And I have to hold myself back, which is, you know, here's my question. Have you thought about doing it this way?
Totally. It's one of the
things. Some of them are more subtle than that. And you still have to be able to say, you know, that's not really a question.
Yeah. Do this ? Is actually a solution. So there's something about questioning. So finally, your thoughts on taking the time to work on your business, not in your business. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, that's something else that I learned through my career, especially as when things get, I don't know what the right word is. I'll use the word chaotic. When you're in a situation in your business where you're struggling with a problem, and it could be anything from a customer issue to a internal personnel issue to a we're not making the numbers issue with your board, anything. It's very tempting to put in more time, put in more focus. And I had a CEO who fell in, who was my immediate boss when I was at an unnamed company, large company, relatively new CEO, came into the job. I had a lot more experience than he did, but I didn't want to be the CEO. But he felt threatened a little bit. And at one point, I realized that what was happening was we needed to make fundamental directional changes, strategic shifts in the business, because we were losing our, we weren't accelerating, we were losing traction in business growth. And so, but his approach was just to try to run faster on the little, treadmill. And if I said to him, let's take some time. Why don't we bring the team together and go spend a day not worrying about this quarter, not worrying about next quarter, not worrying about this problem, but thinking about what's the long-term direction we need for the company, what's happening in the outside. Let's go do that. I can't do that. We don't have time. I've got to solve this problem. And I finally left that company because I realized it was not going to get resolved. And I went and I knew the board very well. I'd been to that company a long time. I knew the board members. I talked to a bunch of them and I mentioned this. And a couple of them made the comment that they were supportive of when he had been made CEO. I'd been in the company already for, I think, 8 years when the prior CEO, who was brilliant, retired and anointed his new replacement. And I was there for another couple of years and talked to the board, and a couple of them said, well, that's just his culture. He doesn't take advice. He doesn't even listen to us. Well, that was a bad sign. And 2 years later, they replaced him. And the analogy I sort of derived from that I use with people all the time is, imagine you're an athlete. You're a, I don't know, a 400 meter runner, and you're competing at the top level. And you're out every day on the track doing your workouts that the coach told you to do. And you seem stuck. You're just not improving your time. And the coach comes over and says, Stephanie, come over here. Let's spend a little bit of time on how you, on your starting position and your form. And you could answer, yes, coach, that's a good idea, which would be the right answer. Or you could answer the more common answer, I can't, I've got to get my training done. I've only got another hour and I've got to do another
Got to run.
50 runs. And company managers and leaders, managers in the company and leaders of companies often fall in that trap. They get caught up on the hamster wheel, chasing it. And if I just run fast enough, well, the problem is at a certain point, you can't run faster. There's some, I'm sure I've seen this in many places in videos. It's almost a meme where you're on a literally on a treadmill and they're turning up the speed and you're turning up and you're running, 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 and eventually you get shot out the back. And that's what happens to leaders. And maybe if you stepped off the treadmill for a while and figured out why is this going faster and faster, you fix the problem. So that's the idea of stepping out of the business, not spending all your time in the business, but spend some time on the business. And what I've done in my own career, aside from having been a member of Vistage for a while, 15 or so years ago, is you have to be very proactive to set that set aside time for that. With as a Vistage member, that on your calendar, it's the third Thursday of every month. We're having a meeting, and you know about it, and you're going to step out of your day-to-day, and you're going to come here. And you may have issues. You can bring them here. That's what it's for. But you're not working in the business. You're thinking about the business from the outside. That's very important. But there are other factors. So there are a few things that I used to do. And this one I recommend to everyone. It's especially relevant for startups, but it's true for every business. Once a year, usually over the year-end holidays, I used to sit down and write a short future history. I would sit down, I would project forward 10 years in the future and write a headline that I want to see for the company. It could be an economic outcome, it could be an impact outcome, it could be whatever's most important. And it's bold. There's a term we use a lot in the startup world, a BHAG, a bold, hairy, audacious goal. So it's really almost, it's almost unimaginably big. But then the rest of the article, because you're writing this like a business article, tells how you got there from where you are. It's a story. If it's a startup, it says, our headline is we just got acquired for $1 billion, if that's your goal. And then it starts, it says, in 2021, this company started in Mark's bedroom at, university, and he did this, and then he did that, and he did it, and it maps it out. And when you look at that, it does two things. One is it gives you that North Star is inspiring to the team. And when you first say it, they say, that's impossible. We can never do that. Oh, we could. Look, here's the story. Here's what we need to do. You connected the dots. So it allows people to raise their ambition and sharpen their focus at the same time. And I found that that is really working on the business, not in the business, because you're essentially ignoring all the current barriers.
What a really interesting exercise, and interesting to have a group of non-competitive peers around you during the year to see as you're living out your story.
Yeah, exactly.
What I've heard from you is science, and I always love science. Science was great. Your story about communication and leading through others, really important. And the importance of CEOs stepping out and getting other perspectives and taking the time out of the business. I think that we are so lucky to have you in our community, and you have so much to offer businesses, certainly in New Zealand and in Australia and across our global community, which is part of Vistage. So wishing you all the very best. Love partnering with you. And thank you so much for your time today on Vistage Live.
Well, thank you. And I'm excited to be part of Vistage for another reason, which is I love learning about other businesses that I'm unfamiliar with.
Yeah.
There's so much interesting. The world is such an interesting place. And again, as an individual leader in a business, it's easy to get very focused, almost myopically, in your business, your industry. And just hearing about these other things and learning about them, I find that fascinating.
That's great. Well, Mark, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
So that's it for Vistage Live today. Thank you for joining us. Make sure you subscribe so you can listen to us each episode. And for more information about Vistage, check us out on vistage.com.au.